Hello and welcome to A Flat Pack History of Sweden, your podcast friend all about the history of this Nordic kingdom. This is episode 99 and today we'll be talking about what happens when the dust settles after Stockholm's bloodbath. So roughly from the end of 1520 to mid-1523. My name is Åsa and sitting across from me is my partner in crime and in podcasting, Chris.
So much crime. And we're sitting on new chairs, which hopefully you won't hear at all, unlike the previous chairs, which occasionally would do an annoying squeak that was sometimes hard to edit out. So hopefully you will never hear these chairs.
Silent chairs.
Exactly, the best kind of chairs. Last episode, we talked about the mad event that was the Stockholm bloodbath that Åsa just mentioned back in November 1520, and that was when King Christian II massacred his enemies in the Swedish nobility and clergy, and in the process managed to chop the heads off of some people who just happened to be in the vicinity of the execution as well. We'll be covering the events that follow on from the bloodbath, which will be decisive for the future of not just Sweden, but the whole of the Nordic region. And we'll see the return of a man who we've briefly mentioned a couple of times, but from now on, he will be a main character in our story, and that is Gustav Vasa. But before we get into all of that, it's time for our Swedish phrase of the week.
This week's phrase is lägga örat mot rälsen, which literally translates to English as to put your ear to the track.
Like a railway track.
Correct. It means to be attentive and think about what might be going on. I guess it's a bit similar to the English phrase, feel which way the wind is blowing. So you could say, for example, there's rumors going around in the office that we might be moving. I might see if I can get to sit in on the team manager's weekly meeting and see if I can lägga örat mot rälsen, put my ear to the track. As in, see if I can pick up on what's going on.
Yeah, or keep an eye out, or something like that. If you actually put your ear to a train track to hear a train approaching, that's probably not a good idea. We don't recommend that as an official policy from A Flat Pack History of Sweden.
No, but I guess if you do that, you do hear the approaching train through the track. So it seems likely that that's where the phrase comes from.
Yeah, and the key point is you can hear it through the rail come from a lot further away than in real life.
We've had our ear to the track, and not just that, we've also done a bit of research as well, so we know what will be coming next now after the bloodbath. The first thing that happens is sort of weirdly grim, or maybe just weird, considering they just had a mass execution in the city. But on the 10th of November, so the same day that they burn all the bodies after the bloodbath, Christian's daughter, Dorothea, is born and named after her mother. And so he holds a celebration to mark that occasion up in Stockholm.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's relatively tasteless, all things considered. But maybe he just wanted to make people try and forget about what happened over the last couple of days and make them focus on something else. Either way, this means he stays in Stockholm for a couple of weeks now, just basking in the glorious feeling that he's now definitely the undisputed king of Sweden and consequently king of all of the Kalmar Union. It seems like he's managed to do what both his namesake and grandfather, the first Christian, and his father, Hans, had failed to do, and kill the Swedish resistance to them as king, and for once united the Kalmar Union. Just before Christmas, he heads out on his Eriksgata. We've seen plenty of these before, but this one's a little bit different. The practice dates back centuries and is when the newly elected king travels around the central parts of Sweden, asserting his supremacy and legitimacy, and technically getting elected from each of the towns or counties he visits along the way.
But with King Christian on the throne, the Eriksgata turns into more of a killing spree. He doesn't kill people personally, but mini bloodbaths are arranged in several of the towns that he visits to make sure that he gets rid of all the influential people and everyone who were previously loyal to Stensture. He also makes sure to bump off rich and powerful merchants and burghers on his way. After all, not all of the influential people in Sweden had come to Stockholm for the coronation, so they weren't caught in the bloodbath. There was some mopping up of people to execute in Norrköping, Linköping, Vadstena, and Jönköping as a vengeful and spiteful monarch lays waste to the cream of the crop of the country.
This is another reason to feel that Christian was behind the Stockholm bloodbath. The bloodbath kickstarts this journey of terror as he ravages the country he's just conquered. It fits his modus operandi, and this journey is simply just part two, or two, three, four, five, and six, of his subjugation campaign. Christian also sends orders to Finland to execute people he thinks are his enemies there too. This order unfortunately spells the end for one of our favourite characters on the podcast over the last couple of episodes, Hemming Gad.
Even though he'd swapped sides whilst being imprisoned as part of Christian's hostage and was now loyal to the king, Gad's name goes on the list too. He'd even helped convince Christina to surrender Stockholm Castle, but Christian is still suspicious enough to not want to have such a smooth political operator and experienced military man left kicking around in Sweden. Hemming had actually been sent to Finland just a few months earlier to act as Christian's sort of governor there, but he soon ends up with the short end of the stick, or rather the sharp end of a blade, when his head is chopped off his body outside the gates of Roseborg Castle on the 16th of December 1520.
Yeah, our favourite bishop, siege expert, kidnap victim, traitor, and all-round brilliant character of the early 1500s is no more, unfortunately. And also, unfortunately, for the rest of Sweden, Christian's revenge doesn't stop there either, as it's time for the next stop on his tour of death. When he gets to Nydala Abbey in Småland in January of 1521, he orders their abbot and several of the monks there to be drowned in a nearby lake because he suspects they've been sympathising with those who fought against him. His orders are carried out, and when the surviving monks write about this in the abbey's annals, they write that Christian is a tyrant. And so a nickname was born, because Christian II will go down in Swedish history as Christian Tyrann, or Christian the Tyrant.
Yeah, he will, to the point where that's still how a lot of popular history books, TV programs, radio and podcasts refer to him. I'm pretty sure my history textbook in school said that as well. And I think if you say Christian II to most people in Sweden, they won't know who you mean, but they'll be familiar with Christian Tyrann. There's a bit of a rumor or sort of old wives' tale in Sweden that actually in Denmark he's called Christian the Good, because he killed so many Swedes. But that isn't the case there. He's just known as Christian II.
Yeah, that would be a bit harsh if they called him Christian the Good. But having concluded his bloody Eriksgator, Christian thankfully doesn't stay around to tyrannize the Swedes anymore, but rather heads home to Copenhagen, because now he's going to turn his attention to something he's been thinking about for a long time now, namely creating that trading company of his that can rival the Hanseatic League. We've seen from the last episode or so that this is pretty much top of his list of priorities now that he's conquered Sweden and finally fully re-established the Kalmar Union. So before he leaves Sweden, he enforces a rule that says the Swedes can only trade through his trading company and there will be an outpost for all foreign trade in Stockholm. No independent foreign trade by local bearsmen will be allowed, for example.
Christian leaves Sweden in the care of four of his loyal men, who happen to all be bishops. They were his longtime supporters and right-hand men from Denmark, and his main Swedish allies, like Archbishop Gustav Trolle and Otto Svinhuvud, who was the new bishop of Västerås. Alongside this quartet of bishops come counselors, new bailiffs and commanders were quickly installed at all of the Swedish and Finnish castles to rule and control local areas. These bailiffs and commanders were all Danish or German, by the way. Not a single Swedish one was appointed. We know how well that's gone down with the locals previously in history, don't we? But more on that later.
Yeah, Christian clearly didn't listen to our previous episodes when he put these people in charge. There are some territorial changes made to Sweden as well. Christian merges some of the western parts of the country with the Danish and Norwegian counties that they border. So Värmland becomes part of Akershus County in Norway. Dalsland also becomes Norwegian when it's merged with Bohus County. And Finnveden is merged with the Danish county Varberg. Obviously, in the centuries that's passed, both Varberg and Bohus, or Bohusland as it's known today, have become Swedish. But in 1520, this constitutes territorial changes intended to further limit Sweden's power and identity as an independent place from the rest of the Kalmar Union. So it's formally taking away quite a bit of land and putting them in the Danish or Norwegian corner of the Kalmar Union.
So we see how this time, the aftermath of the latest Swedish uprising is arguably much harsher than previously. Christian and his allies have really gone in for quashing the Swedish resistance once and for all, and now they're intending to maintain that control by redrawing the borders and making sure loyal foreigners are in power locally.
Yeah, it's a heavy-handed blow that's landed on Sweden this time, and Christian likely thought that he'd done a good job and done a clean sweep through Swedish society. But who's that popping his head out from where he's been hiding? Well, it's Gustav Eriksson Vasa.
Yeah, hello GV, as we call him in our notes. Let's just call him Gustav. We've mentioned him a couple of times in previous episodes, but just to recap, Gustav Eriksson Vasa, member of the Swedish nobility, his dad, Erik Johansson Vasa, was a knight and a member of the council, but he's just been killed in the bloodbath, though. Gustav's mother, Cecilia, was also a member of the nobility and had been imprisoned following the bloodbath, so she's now down in Copenhagen, where she'll actually die in captivity. Cecilia is Kristina Gyllenstierna's sister, so through that family link, Gustav is connected to the Stures and the last few regents that ruled Sweden, Sten Sture being Gustav's uncle through marriage. Gustav Vasa was likely born on the 12th of May, 1496, so he's around 25 years old at this point. He first appeared in the story as a soldier in a few battles against Christian, but really sprung onto the scene as part of the group of hostages that Christian took when he snubbed Sten Sture back in 1518, so Gustav was on the boat alongside Hemingad.
He's been kept prisoner at Karlø Castle on Jutland in Denmark. Actually, it was more like house arrest, as he was kept in pretty nice conditions, not just chucked away in a dungeon somewhere. But unlike Hemingad, who swapped sides and joined Christian, along with the four other hostages too, actually, Gustav Vasa never submits to Christian and swaps sides. In fact, in September 1519, the year before the bloodbath, he'd managed to escape and headed to Lübeck. Some say he just walked out the front door of his house arrest, as it wasn't that, you know, strictly guarded, and some say that he dressed up as a peasant to do it. I hope he just put on a really big fake moustache and walked out the front door. Hola, señor guard, I am not Gustav Vasa, soy señor Gustav Vasarvo.
Why would he have a Spanish accent?
Why not? Because he's Gustavo Vasarvo. That's the disguise.
No historical records indicate that that's what happened, but if you like to have that image in your head, fair enough. Gustav Vasa wanted to continue the fight against Christian, despite overwhelming odds against him, and realized that in order to do so, Sweden would likely need money and support from abroad. So that's why he heads to Lübeck, a prominent Hansa town at this point. There, he actually managed to rally support, not least because Lübeck was fearing Denmark's increased power and trade ambition. As we've seen before, the Hansa always considered a joint Scandinavia a threat to their trade domination. Lübeck had been in and out of the various Scandinavian wars over the years by now. It usually didn't matter which side they were on, they just wanted to stop a united Scandinavia. And this time around, they're even more worried because of King Christian's overt plans to build his own trading company and align himself more with the Netherlands and their trading empire, not least through his queen, who came from the royal house of Castile, who ruled the Netherlands at the time.
So Lübeck had their reasons for not wanting to see Christian unite Scandinavia and push ahead with his expansive plans for trade, and this made them throw their support behind the young Gustav Vasa. Having this support and cash from Lübeck will be key in what happens next. In return for the money, Gustav has promised Lübeck extensive trade privileges, including that he will stop Danish merchants trading east of the Øresund, which is basically all of the Baltic Sea and the Bay of Bothnia. If this would be put in place, Denmark would effectively be cut off from Baltic Sea trade, and the Hansa would be able to dominate that area entirely. And he also offers some other privileges to them too, which we'll talk about in episode 101.
When Sten Sture is killed in March 1520, Gustav Vasa starts putting plans into place for his return to Sweden. He returns to his home country in May of that year, so that's after Sweden had almost completely fallen to Christian, but before Christina surrendered Stockholm to the Danish king in September. Initially, though, he just lays low and tries to stay out of sight. But who is this Gustav Vasa, really? Politically, he is very much a man of the same type as Sten Sture, both the older and the younger, actually, in that he advocates for a return to the good old days, so a strong, independent Sweden, where there are no foreigners and local power as bailiff and commanders, or indeed no foreign king on the throne, as in no monarch that's seen as Danish ruling Sweden as part of a joint Scandinavian union. Even if we saw that the Sten Stures didn't ultimately take the final step of ensuring Sweden was completely free of the Kalmar Union, that is what Gustav Vasa is more strongly advocating.
In some ways, Gustav represented continuity. He came from an old noble family with a base in the Swedish heartland in Uppland County, where Gustav was likely born at the family estate of Riddboholm. We mentioned that his dad had been a knight and a councillor, and so had his grandfather and great-grandfather. Moreover, he was related to the Sture family, as we said, so in that sense, Gustav was definitely part of the old guard. But in other ways, he represented something new. He absolutely didn't want to continue with the old ways and somehow find a way for Sweden to fit back into the Kalmar Union. He wanted to sever completely those ties and start something new. It's always hard to know at what point in a historical person's life they develop the ideas and ambitions that will guide them later on, and certainly when it starts to make them famous.
Exactly, and for now he's a 25-year-old nobleman who's escaped captivity, scraped some cash together by promising Lübeck he's the solution to their fear of Christian getting too strong.
Gustav tries to keep a low profile though, as we mentioned, even after he's made it back to Sweden in the summer of 1520. He likely knows that if he's going to pull anything off against Christian, he needs to find the right time and the right place and have more to throw at the fight than just money from Lübeck. Unlike his father and most of his nobleman friends, he definitely doesn't attend the coronation, and consequently he avoids the bloodbath as well. There are rumours he received an invitation though, but he doesn't attend. If he did receive an invitation, then his decision to not go might have been the best decision of his life, or probably would have ended his life at that point. Instead, he continues to lay low, moving around the estates of different friends in his part of the country. He then gets the news about the bloodbath, and his father is one of the dead, and almost the entire political leadership of Sweden has been wiped out.
Gustav isn't the only person shocked by this outrage. By January 1521, or perhaps even as early as Christmas 1520, so very soon after Christian had left Sweden after his bloody rampage, uprisings start to break out. The first sign of trouble comes from Småland, where a local petty nobleman leads the peasants in a rebellion. The foreign knights and bailiffs that the king has put in place are attacked and killed when they're on their way to the local courts. Those fortunate enough to escape death were driven away from their estates and had all their property stolen. Admiral Søren Norby, who had commanded Christian's fleet several times during his fight with Sweden between 1517 and 1520, he was now the commander of Kalmar Castle, and from there he deploys a force to deal with this uprising. But it fails. By February, the Danes have almost entirely lost control of Småland.
Which is amazing when you think about it. Christian thought he was on top of the world and had all the power, considering the major political leadership in Sweden was gone by now. But we know those pesky Swedish peasants, you can't ever turn your back on them. And as we move through the first few months of 1521, it's not just in Småland that we see uprisings and violent protest from the local communities. This is now spreading across Västergötland, Dalarna and Dalsland as well. So what are they so angry about? Is it just the bloodbath? They're angry that loads of noblemen have been killed up in Stockholm? Or maybe there's a new tax again? That's always something.
Well, actually, for once, local Swedish peasants aren't getting up in arms about taxes. That's, like you said, usually what rallies them. And likely, the bloodbath isn't their motivation either, because whilst it had been a horrible thing, it had targeted the elite, both in Stockholm and elsewhere. It was the noblemen and high clergy that Christian and Gustav Trolle had wanted to get at. So that was certainly a motivation for someone like Gustav Vasa, who had been personally affected by those atrocities, and that meant he wanted to get back at Christian. But it wouldn't have been enough to incite anger in a local community far away in another part of Sweden.
Similarly, whilst in Stockholm the local burghers and servants had been victims of the massacre, again, Sweden is quite a disconnected country with strong local communities but weak national coherence at this point. There had been a bit of a sense of Sweden versus Denmark in the wars between Stenstura and Svante Nilsson and Denmark, but that was a bit different. The regents had spent years travelling around Sweden and building up popular personal support for those previous rebellions. Peasants in Småland aren't naturally going to rise up in revenge at the drop of a hat just because of what happened to people in Stockholm. It can be quite hard to understand, really, when you think of it in a modern perspective, but this seems to be the case back then. Whilst we've seen Swedish peasants rise up time and time again over the last 100 years or so in the timeline, they only really do so when they and their community are directly affected by something going on. And this time, though, one of those somethings is a new decree by Christian that forbids them from carrying weapons.
What? That is outrageous. I mean, I can see why Christian thinks it's a bad idea to have masses of armed individuals walking around in a country that he's just fought a war with for years, then committed a hostile takeover of, including large-scale massacres, and now put a bunch of non-native people in charge of. Yeah, like, I'd be scared of having peasants with crossbows walking around if I had just done that to a country.
Yeah, you can see why he's done this, because then the peasants would just be there waiting for the next charismatic leader to show up and rally them to attack the foreign king. Basically, Christian doesn't want an Engelbrektsson or a Stenstura the Elder on his hands.
So yeah, it's easy to see why the king doesn't want this. The problem is, the peasants want to have the right to carry weapons. They really, really, really want that right. Why? Well, because they've always had the right to carry weapons, and they don't want that to change. End of. In fact, Swedish peasants don't want much to change in general. They're quite a conservative bunch. Conservative with a small c, not the political party. Again, we've seen several times how they've joined in rebellions and uprisings, not so much because they wanted something new or wanted something to change, but because they wanted things to go back to the way they were, or the way the peasants perceived things to have been. If peasants can be rallied around a move for change, it's often when that change can be sold to them as a change that returns them to the good old days. Like, return to before we were in this pesky union where we had to send money and troops to fight some stupid war in Schleswig-Holstein. We don't know where that is or care. We want to go back to the good old days. That's the sort of thing that you can rally Swedish peasants in the 14 and 1500s to support.
Yeah, or, you know, well, back when the local tyrannical bailiff was Björn from down the road, not Olof Pedersen from down in Denmark. We want a local Swedish tyrant running our local village.
Exactly, you know, if you're going to be subjected to someone, you want to be subjected to a local guy, not a Danish guy.
Yeah, so you can definitely see when compared to, I don't know, the 18 or 1900s, when the Swedish peasants and worker class are rising up and demanding new rights, like the right to vote, and women protesting about the right to vote, or, you know, really rubbish pay conditions and things like that. They want new things. They're not saying, can we go back to the 1400s and looking back to the past? But that's what the Swedish peasants in the 1500s are doing. They're actually looking back to the past. They don't want new things. They want the old times back. They're not asking for democracy. And so the peasants all up and down the country are angry with Christian's decree forbidding them from carrying weapons. And they're also angry because Christian is preventing them from trading freely. Because remember, he's forced them all to trade via his own trading company if they want to export abroad. This upsets both farming communities in places like Småland and Västergötland, who want to sell their grain and animal products to the highest bidder, and it really angers mining communities in Dalarna, whose wealth depends on them trading their iron freely, and in particular to Hansa merchants. So it's both peasants and more wealthy burghers and traders too who are affected by this. It's not just stopping the Swedish council and really rich businessmen from doing this trade, it's also affecting local, normal people all around Sweden. But Christian has these strong trade ambitions and wants to set up his own trading company to rival the Hansa. So he couldn't care less about what these peasants and merchants thought of him.
So in short, no crossbows, no profit equals angry peasants. It's like the Swedish peasants at this time are half Klingon, half Ferengi, and they're being prevented from doing the two things they really love to do, fight and trade.
It's a brilliant Star Trek reference. For those of our listeners who understand the reference, I can imagine all the Swedish peasants now in the 1520s who looked half Klingon with the sort of the head ridges, and then half Ferengi with giant ears. For those of you who don't know anything about Star Trek, the Klingons are a warrior race, and the Ferengi are super space capitalists. So just imagine a mixture of those people. These are the Swedish peasants.
Now back to Sweden. Gustav Vasa must have popped his head out of the window and seen all these angry Klingon Ferengi peasants starting to kick off, and then looked back at his suitcase where he was keeping all his Lübeck cash and thought to himself, I've got two good ingredients for a rebellion, money through foreign support and angry peasants. Like Meatloaf said, two out of three ain't bad. It's time to rebel.
The third thing he needs for this to become an all-out rebellion against King Christian and his Danish-German bailiffs and commanders is, of course, an actual proper army. And so he heads off to Dalarna.
Of course, because as we've seen time and time again, Dalarna is a one-stop shop if you want a rebel army in this period of history. Before we go any further into this, we should bear in mind that Gustav Vasa's journey around Sweden in 1520 and 1521 has been highly mythicized in Swedish history, especially this bit about how he got the support from the peasants in Dalarna. This mythicizing actually began in his own time, because as we'll see, Gustav was nothing short of a propaganda genius. And then it was added on by national romantic Swedish historians in the 1800s and early 1900s. So that just added fuel to the fire when they looked back at these figures in Swedish history, like Sten Sture the Elder and his rebel rousing. So as we go forward now, just keep that in mind.
Definitely, because a lot of what we know, in quotation marks, comes from a chronicle by a guy called Peder Svart, who wrote down a chronicle about Gustav Vasa's life a few decades later. And he basically wrote it on commission from Gustav Vasa. So yeah, like all these things, it's probably at least a bit embellished. But now the peasants in Dalarna are already rebelling against Christian's men, but it's small scale and with limited success. Gustav likely headed off from his family's estate in Refsnes on the shores of Lake Mälaren. According to Peder Svart's chronicle, Gustav was travelling on horseback and with a servant with him, but the servant stole the horse and all their luggage and ran away. However, Gustav then found the servant and got the horse back, and presumably all the money from his suitcase too. And in likely what is a way to portray Gustav as magnanimous, the chronicle claims that he didn't punish the servant, just told him to go away and he would continue by himself, but he definitely stabbed him in the chest, in our version of the story.
What could quite conceivably be true is that Gustav travelled around disguised as a farmer to not attract attention from Christian's local commanders. He isn't going to be a nationally recognised figure at this point, with his paintings all around the country or Danish guards out looking for him, but he doesn't want to be travelling around dressed like a Swedish nobleman. After all, there aren't that many left of them, so it'd be quite obvious and maybe would attract attention. Gustav's first stop on his personal crusade to gather a rebel force is his friend Anders Persson's estate in Rankhyttan in southern Dalarna. Apparently, Anders Persson was a friend from when Gustav had spent a few years as a teenager studying at Uppsala University. In fact, going to see old uni friends to ask for their help will very much be Gustav's modus operandi in this venture.
But he doesn't seem to have too much luck with his old study buddy, because Anders asks him to leave right away, afraid that Gustav will attract all the kinds of wrong attention from the king's men. At this point, the chronicle contains a story that's likely not true, and that is to keep a low profile and wait for the right moment to speak to his friend. When he first arrived at Rankhyttan, Gustav didn't make himself known, but instead just took a job harvesting his field there. And it was only when a maid spotted the collar of his fancy shirt sticking up from above his farmer's outfit that she went to tell her master. And that was when Anders found out his old friend turned wannabe rebel leader was farming in his field because he was too afraid to just say hello. Like, what is going on here?
Yeah, I think that's totally not true. But from Rankhyttan, Gustav continued just over 15 kilometers up the road to the Ornes estate, where another of his old uni friends, Arendt Persson, lives. According to the chronicle, on his way there, he nearly drowned when the ice cracked as he was crossing a small river, but God saved him, so that's good for him.
Yeah, well, at least Gustav's got God on his side, because so far he hasn't got anyone else. Whilst Arendt at first seems willing to help, Gustav ends up leaving empty-handed there too, and so he heads up the road to an estate of a man called Måns Nilsson in Asperboda, but he's also unwilling to help, so that's 3 out of 3 times he's struck out. Meanwhile, whilst Gustav is gone, Arendt goes to Christian's bailiff for the Bergslagen and Dalarna region and basically rats him out. And the bailiff decides to arrest Gustav Vasa and heads off to Ornes to get him.
Wow, some friend, that Arendt. What a snitch. However, Gustav will dodge the bailiff thanks to Arendt's wife, Barbro Stigsdotter, who helps him escape. Now, this is another point that has been incredibly mythicized. First in the chronicle, then by historians, painters. It's even depicted in old Swedish movies. Just to cut a long story short, Barbro had figured out that her husband had gone to tell on Gustav to the bailiff and warned him. Apparently, Gustav was staying in the Loftbod. It's a type of two-story wooden storage building where the second floor sort of hung out a bit over the side of the first floor. It seems on this estate, the family had their primitive indoor toilet basically just a hole straight down on the second floor of that building. And when the bailiff was coming, Barbro helped Gustav lower himself down through that hole and run away.
So they basically escaped through the toilet, and I guess that makes it a good movie scene. But yeah, anyway. In reality, it's a bit inexplicable why Gustav didn't just go through the door, because it would have taken at least a day to get to Orness. So, yeah, this is probably being made up for dramatic effect. And the Orness estate is still there today, actually, and this building with the poop chute, or whatever it's called, has been a museum since 1758, when the then owner figured out it was much more profitable to restore it and have people come and view the magical toilet hole through which the national hero Gustav Vasa escaped from, rather than carrying on farming. Which is amazing, really, because this toilet has been a museum longer than America has been an independent country. Which is one famous poopy shoot. And Orsa's laughing her head off. She can't continue.
It's just when you put in that perspective, like, whilst George Washington was fighting for independence from, the British, there's some guy in Dalarna that went...
turning his toilet into a museum.
And it's been a museum since.
Yeah.
We have to go there. How many people go to view a toilet hole that a national hero likely didn't escape from?
This guy just saw the money signs falling out of this toilet.
I'm sorry, if representatives from the Orness Poop Hole Museum is listening to this, I'm not dissing on your museum. I think it's an amazing piece of entrepreneurship. Back to Gustav. From Orness, he heads to another friend from university.
Which is amazing. He keeps in touch with more of his friends from university than I do. And this was back in a time when they didn't have, like, class reunions and all those kind of things. Although I wasn't trying to raise an army, so that's probably why he's doing this. So he visits his next friend called Jun in the village of Sverdsjö, which means Sword Lake. Which, I mean, if you're going to ask anyone to join your army and they live in a place called Sword Lake, you better hope that they do. But it seems like maybe Jun didn't do that, because Gustav Vasa has to continue on to the town of Rättvik.
In Rättvik, his luck does seem to turn a bit, because here the peasants are decidedly more keen to join the rebellion. But they're still not entirely convinced Gustav is the man to follow. They tell Gustav that if he can get the other parishes around Dalarna to join in, then Rättvik will as well. So with that half a promise, Gustav heads to Mora, the town in the very heart of Dalarna. Whilst all this is going on, news of Gustav's journey around Dalarna and his agitation to get the peasants to join him in a rebellion reaches Henrik von Mehlen, Christian's closest ally and commander of Västerås Castle. As commander of that castle, Henrik holds local power and is the king's man when it comes to Dalarna and Bergslagen. Henrik von Mehlen doesn't waste any time thinking about what to do. He wants this crushed, and crushed swiftly. So he sends a small group of people out to find Gustav and kill him.
So now Gustav is being chased by assassins sent after him by the local castle commander. In a somewhat surprising turn of events, Gustav actually gets help from a Dane, a man by the name of Erasmus Ute, who's heard of the assassination order and finds Gustav to warn him. Even though he was Danish, Erasmus has been loyal to the Sture family in the past, and so he wants to continue that by helping Gustav. Together, they actually find the assassin that's been sent in the direction of Mora, where Gustav's been staying at the home of a local lensman. Lensman is sort of like a low-level bailiff. He's not in charge of, like, a whole county or anything, just a much smaller area. Together, they find the assassin, and they catch up with him, and they don't take any chances. They just kill him on the spot, because why would you do anything else?
After having reunions with a bunch of his old uni friend and bumping off a paid assassin, Gustav finally gets the chance to address the peasants in Mora. This is another one of those points in the story that have been highly mythicized, including in paintings and in old films. In fact, we'll link to a large painting of the event that's in the National Gallery in Sweden in the episode notes.
Gustav was supposedly a really good orator and gave a rousing speech to the assembled Mora peasants. In it, he told them all about the horrific event of the bloodbath and tried to evoke memories of the previous rebellions against foreign rulers, especially about how people from Dalarna helped kick out the much-hated Danish bailiff Jussa Eriksson during the Engelbrecht Rebellion nearly 100 years earlier at Vesterås Castle.
Still, in spite of all his best speaking skills and trying to build on past rebellions, the peasants, well, frankly, they don't really care. This whole thing with the bloodbath, yeah, sounds terrible, but it doesn't concern their day-to-day life. And again, we've seen this before. Swedish peasants will only join a rebellion if they can be roused to anger about something very close to their home and life, like a tax increase or an unfair foreign bailiff controlling the local area. So when the Mora peasants say, "Nah, not this time, mate," to Gustav Vasa, he realizes that the rest of the peasants in Dalarna aren't going to join him en masse either. He can't just give up and go back home, though. He's now a wanted man after von Mehlen has set his sights on him. So from Dalarna, there's only one way to go. He has to continue west into Norway and hope that the Norwegians will, if not support him, then at least let him rest in exile for a bit there. So off west he goes.
However, a week or so after Gustav has left for Norway, a man called Lasse Odson visits Mora. We don't know who this guy was, if he was a local or what role he had, but it's clear he's from further south in Sweden or been there on a trip, and he's heard news that he's now bringing back to Dalarna. And basically what he says just corroborates what Gustav was saying in his fiery speeches, but more importantly for the Mora peasants, they hear that not only was there a bloodbath in Stockholm, King Christian had continued this bloodbathing in towns and local communities further south, and what's even worse is that the king is talking about raising new taxes. So this is soon corroborated further when a nobleman from Uppland comes to town and verifies this news.
Hearing the words "new taxes" must have been like waving a piece of red cloth in front of a bull. The Mora peasants certainly aren't going to stand for that, and they agree that the best course of action is to try and get Gustav back and then join his proposed rebellion. They pick the two fastest skiers in their community. One of them supposedly, and if it's true, quite ironically, was called Engelbrecht, and they set out to catch up with Gustav.
This race with the two skiers from Mora trying to catch up with Gustav Vasa as he's heading towards Norway is one of the most famous parts of Swedish history, and also probably exaggerated. During the era of national romanticism in Sweden, historians and writers love to dwell on this moment and the image of the two skiers racing across the snow-covered hills and fields to catch up with the man who wanted to lead the rebellion against the foreign king. That period was in the late 1800s, and that happened to coincide with the birth of the modern sport movement in Sweden, and of course the one of skiing. Sweden has had ideal conditions for cross-country skiing like throughout history, and that was already a popular sport at this time, so what better than combining a much-loved sport with a striking nationalistic historical event? And with that, the Vasaloppet ski race was born.
The Vasaloppet ski race is a kind of reenactment of when the two skiers from Mora were going to catch up with Gustav Vasa. I say kind of because they don't race the exact same distance that they would have done back then. And most importantly, the modern race goes the other way around. Whereas Gustav Vasa and his two followers went from Mora towards Norway, the modern skiers go the other way around. They go from a village called Sälen and finish in Mora. This was to allow the finishing line to be in Mora, which is a bigger town, and it was also their local skiing club that took the initiative to the modern competition, so they wanted the finish line and all the celebration in their town and not the other way around.
And the modern Vasaloppet is a 90-kilometer race, so that's 55 miles. So it falls under the category of long lop, or long-distance ski races, which are any race over 10 kilometers, so it's nine times longer than what a long lop has to be. And the first race was held back in 1922, which makes Vasaloppet the oldest still-running long-distance cross-country ski race in the world. And this year is its 100th occasion. It's not the 100 years, because there are a couple were cancelled. So this year is the 100th year, and it happened only 5 or 6 days ago on the date of recording this. So that's really, we're really in time for it here, talking about it now. And today there are also different versions of the race, such as shorter ones, a running one, a biking one, and a one just where women do it, and one where just kids do it, and there's loads of all kinds of stuff going on. So it's really become a major part of Swedish culture, so much so that the Swedish king has done it quite a few times, and the royal family do it, and prime ministers do it, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, it's very much made its way into sort of a general culture in the country. It's shown live on TV, kind of how the London or Boston marathons are. Plus, the Vasaloppet also makes up one of the four events that we call a Swedish classic. What do you think the other three events are?
Eating meatballs, fighting a bear, and putting up a IKEA shelf as fast as possible.
No, although they all sound like fun events.
Fighting a bear? That doesn't sound like fun at all.
No, that sounds quite horrible. I think one event should be fastest escape out a poop hole, then ski towards Norway. But a Swedish classic, as a thing you talk about here, and that is when you race the Vasaloppet ski race, you finish the 30-kilometer long Lidingöloppet, that's a cross-country run.
Right outside our house.
Yeah, and then you swim the Vansbro open water swimming race, and finally you cycle the Vättern runt race, where you cycle around our second largest lake, and that is a bike race that's 315 kilometers long, or 195 miles.
Yeah, that's why it's dangerous saying the country's second largest lake when you have a lot of lakes in Sweden.
True. So doing those four events, the skiing, the running, the open water swimming, and the cycling, all in the same year, that's known as a Swedish classic. It's not for the faint-hearted. In my experience, it's mainly for men with a midlife crisis, but, you know, each to their own.
One guy did it all in one day, where he took like a helicopter between the different races and stuff.
Yeah, that's just crazy people.
One person who wouldn't have done the Vasaloppet race was actually Gustav Vasa himself, because in the 1500s, skiing was something only poor people did. People who couldn't afford other means of transport than to walk, or when it was snowy, some strapped carved wooden planks to their feet and invented skiing. Or didn't invent skiing, but they were like, oh, let's do skiing instead of walking. And Gustav was a wealthy nobleman, so he could afford to rent a sledge and pay someone to take him to the Norwegian border, a bit like a snow tax. And even if he didn't do that, he probably would have wanted to use snowshoes and walk instead, because that's just what they did instead.
So maybe they should change the Vasaloppet to be a snowshoe race.
Well, at least the people chasing after him were on skis, so I guess it still counts. Eventually, these people on skis chasing up with him did catch up with Gustav near the village of Lima, not the capital of a South American country, but a small village in Sweden, which is actually only about 50 kilometers from the border of Norway. And they tell him what has been going on back in Mora, and that the peasants have now changed their minds, and they will now sacrifice their life and blood to bring him back to Mora, which is a bit of a change in attitude there pretty quickly. And according to Petter Svart's Chronicle, they asked him, please, for the sake of God, come back to the people who were waiting to join his rebellion. And it's probably fair to say they didn't take too much convincing to bring the rebel, hungry, the rebellious Gustav Vasa back to Mora to start the rebellion for real.
Meanwhile, news of this has spread around Dalarna, and when Gustav comes back to Mora, it's not just the peasants there, but peasants from parishes across West and East Dalarna who are eager and willing to join in a rebellion against King Christian, against the foreign bailiff, the new taxes, and to avenge those killed in the bloodbath.
Yeah, it's a bit of everything, really. And before they all set off on the rebellion, they gather around and elect, or proclaim, Gustav to be Sveriges Rikes Hervitsman. And Hervitsman is that title we've seen a couple of times before now, and it's in the Middle Ages, and throughout the 1500s, it was a common title given to the highest military commander. And so the peasants in Dalarna, they elect Gustav, this supreme commander of the Swedish kingdom, which of course they have no right to do, and Gustav has no legitimacy in this role, but it goes to show the peasants' intentions, and is of course something that Gustav himself uses in his propaganda to big himself up and make the rebellion as big as possible.
So Gustav Vasa finally has his rebel force, and a rebellion is now brewing across Sweden. I really get the feeling that this is a powder keg ready to blow.
Just like Viborg Castle.
Yep.
That's something we'll have to see what happens next time, because this has been a very long episode so far, so I think we'll stop there and see what happens to Gustav and the rebelling Swedes next time around.
Until then, don't forget to follow us on Facebook and X Twitter. Leave a review on whatever platform you listen to us on, and if you want to write us an email, the address is flatpackhistorysweden@gmail.com.
And we'll end the episode with a nice reference back to our second ever special episode from way back in January 2021. Oliver has just moved into a 1940s block of flats here in Sweden and went to check if there was a bomb shelter in the building, and there is one. But just like ours, it's been turned into a storage room, so it isn't really official anymore. And it doesn't have that well-known triangle sign which says shelter room in it either.
That's still cool and nice that you went to check it out. Thanks for letting us know about your old shelter, Oliver. We always keep an eye out for them and like showing them off to visitors who come see us in Sweden. It's a kind of a funny quirk that we have these old bomb shelters still around.
Yeah, it's really good fun. Special episode number two, if you want to remind yourself about all the bomb shelters that exist in many civilian buildings in Sweden. But that's a good point to end this episode, and we'll just have to say see you in a couple of weeks if you're listening live, and if you're catching up, binge listening, we'll see you in about 25 seconds time.
Exactly. Goodbye.
Hej då.